All right, it is Butcher Box, everybody. With Butcher Box, you get peace of mind, ultimate convenience, and incredible value. You can now find high-quality meat and seafood you can trust. 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, pork-raised, crate-free, and wild-caught seafood. You don't know what it's going to do. Humanely raised, no antibiotics or added hormones. The ultimate convenience, being delivered right to your doorstep and with free shipping always. The value is incredible. You get a variety of high-quality cuts, exclusive member deals, recipe inspirations, guides, tips, and hacks. Butcher Box is convenient. There's nothing like having everything you need for dinner right there in the freezer. The value is incredible and absolutely the best way to get quality food. With Butcher Box, you don't have to worry about what's for dinner. Today, Butcher Box is giving our listeners free ground beef for life for the life of your membership, plus an additional $20 off your first order. Use my link, butcherbox.com/burr, and use the code burr to get free ground beef for life plus $20 off your first box. That's butcherbox.com and code burr, B-U-R-R.
Hey, what's going on? It's Bill Burr, and it's time for a very special edition of the Monday morning podcast or the Thursday afternoon just before Friday podcast, whatever the hell you want to call it. I have a very special guest here. This is a guy I've been a fan of since, I don't know, like the first time I saw him, 82 or 83. Please welcome drumming legend, Mr. Kenny Aronoff.
Yeah, man.
What's going on, dude?
Yeah, it's so cool to see you because the first time I saw you was a buddy of mine in Chicago said, you got to see this guy. I went, can I swear on this show?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, so Jesus, going, yes. Yes.
I went, oh my God, this fucker's from Massachusetts or something.
Yeah, I didn't know. I always thought you were a New York guy. I didn't know you were Massachusetts.
You know what? So my mom grew up in the Bronx because I grew up in Exit 2, which we were talking about, in Stockbridge. For some reason, I adapted that New York thing.
Yeah.
It was not that pocket car and Apple. It was like, motherfucker, you know, like the...
But that's a weird part of Massachusetts. He's talking Exit 2 on the Mass Pike where I was telling you I had one of the worst gigs in Lee, Massachusetts, yeah. Starting out, like, you know, leaving there, people throwing
redneck
shit at me.
Town.
Yeah. They were bored is what I thought. And they just were looking for someone to beat the shit out of. And I looked like Ron Howard. So that was going to be an easy night for them.
But you showed them that you were a fucking kung fu guy.
No, I didn't. I just remember standing up there and so bad wanted to say something. I knew all they wanted me to do was just say that one thing. And they like, cause they had this look on their face. Like, come on, Freckles, say it. And I was just like, I am going to get, like, curb stomped. So I didn't say shit, and I got paid. And they were, like, following me around, like, this group. And they threw this dinner roll at me. They missed. And it was weird. It was, like, this weird – I've told this story before. It was like this function room, and next door to it was another function room. It was part of this restaurant. And yeah. Then the other room was, like, a bachelor party. And there was no closed door. And they just saw me standing there bombing in this restaurant. And I just became this entertainment thing. And
was it downtown Lee?
Is there a downtown? I don't even remember.
It's a one stop.
No, it was. I remember pulling out of there, and it was just like this. Remind me that bar that they went to in Porky's. Remember that? That was just in the middle of the fucking woods. Yeah. It was like that. I'm sure it's all developed now, but I remember when I finally pulled out my little piece of shit Ranger. I had my head out the window like Ace Ventura going, fuck yeah, you fucking good. They were just laughing. I probably took, 5 years off my life that night. So anyways, but that's a weird part of Massachusetts where there's Patriots fans and Giants fans. You start to get into that.
Because you're 20 minutes from the border of
from
New York.
From the border, yeah. So there's Yankee fans and Red Sox fans. It's kind of like Connecticut, sort of halfway through.
Yeah.
You start getting out that way, like, who do you root for? So I guess, I don't know. But your parents, you said your mom was from the Bronx, so.
She was from the Bronx, and my dad was from Paterson, New Jersey, and then they all kind of lived in New York for a while. And then my dad got, he was studying paper and chemistry, so in Lee, there was a mill there. There were all these little mills up there in New England on the river, and he worked for a division of Kimberly Clark.
I hope they pour shit in the drinking water out there.
Dude, we all...
After that gig. No, I'm kidding.
We used to say, man, if you're in a boat and you fall into that river, it's acid will burn you alive.
I mean, know. They just used
it
to...
stunk in the summer. It was so bad. They just dump chemicals in there.
Yeah. Just wash it out.
They don't
the ocean.
Do shit like that anymore, do they?
No, not at all. Not at all. It's all good water. That's why we got the
water.
The tap water.
The earth.
I know.
And the air.
I know. That's what's so fucked up about all this shit that people are always talking about on social media. Like, it's this big goddamn deal. Like, fat shaming and all of this shit. It's like, dude, Those are those problems are so down the fucking line.
Yeah, I know.
As far as like what is going on right
How
now.
About the air?
Yeah.
Or water.
All of that. Yeah, all the shit you
There's
need.
There's some place in Africa in 1 month they're going to run out of water. Period.
I can't listen to it because it just because there's no fucking solution. No one pays attention. And then if you try to address it, conservatives blame liberals and liberals blame conservatives. And then they just keep plowing ahead. And they don't want to
hear what I'm going to say.
What are you going to say?
Well, they've been, I don't know. I'm pretty strong about, like, you know, people are fucking still in, they're like little kindergartners still. I don't care how old you are. I don't think the world is evolving at all. Maybe with technology.
Technology it is.
But it's the same shit. I cannot believe. Like, who gives a fuck about that and who gives a fuck about that? Are you really that uptight about that? Holy shit.
Right. No, I know what you mean.
Or like, you know, some big issues, which I won't mention, where they're squabbling. Dude, just make a little adjustment.
No, but this is the thing. Now you have to dance around because you're like, some big issues that I'm not going to remember. You're upset about this. And I know every issue that you're fucking talking about, but you can't bring it up because then you have like,
That's my point.
You have 80 soccer moms. And this is the thing. 80 soccer moms will actually make the news because they're going to talk about that.
Okay.
For whatever fucking reason. So you got it.
It's going to make the news now.
You got to dance between the raindrops.
Right, I'm going to get my ass kicked.
Dude, we got to get some padding on this table. Any sort of shifting of weight.
That's right. So anyway, check. So, man, I'm going to get my ass kicked right now. But I grew up in Western Mass, super liberal, super Democratic, you know, just everybody, just when they vote Democratic all the way down, doesn't matter if it was Hitler, if he's a Democrat, on the Democratic side. I'm just blown away. I call them vicious liberals.
I was living out here. I know. It's crazy.
No, but people are so, like, a real true liberal was my dad. A liberal, my dad, you know, we grew up Jewish, but my dad would listen to Hitler talk just to see what he had to say. Wouldn't yell at him. He would talk, and then he'd tell Hitler that he was fucked in so many words. But he would at least talk.
What do you mean? He like knew the guy, or he's watching
the
tape?
No, but I'm just saying
he's talking to the TV.
He's a true liberal.
I was just thinking, like, that was the ultimate, like, fucking Odd Couple movie. Were they, like, roommates in college or some shit?
No, actually, my dad was bombing Hitler in World War II.
Oh, he was?
He was in the bombers that just leveled Hitler, you know. But my point is, my dad was a true liberal. He would listen to anybody, didn't matter what it is. But nowadays, it's like, I call them vicious liberals. They're like, they're more conservative and radical.
They totally are.
A true liberal is somebody who listens and will at least accept somebody else's opinion, no matter how radical it is. Liberal is your open-minded.
Accept the fact that you have that opinion. You'll listen to it and everything.
Right. But, you know, this viciousness is like, it's like.
No, there's destroying careers. They will just, if you have, like, it's basically, we're liberal, think what we think. But if you don't, we're going to go after your career. And it's like, it's no different than I remember what happened to the Dixie Chicks when they just expressed their opinion about the current president.
Yep.
And I remember like Fox News was saying like, well, they have a right to state their opinion and we have a right to have, you know, state our opinion. It's like, you didn't state your opinion. You stated your opinion, then you systematically tried to destroy their fucking ability to earn a living. That's not tit for tat.
No.
You know what I mean? So whatever.
That's what I'm saying. That's sandbox stuff. Everyone's still a bunch of little kids still. Yeah. How do we get on that?
I don't know, but I want to talk, because I know everybody always talks to you about drumming and all that type of shit.
I don't mind.
What nobody doesn't talk to you about, dude, I don't want to say how old you are, but
I'm old.
Okay, you're old. How do you stay in the fucking shape you're in?
Yeah.
You're shredded.
Yeah, well, you know, and this is me kind of out of shape, because I'm so busy right now. But you know what happened was, at a certain point in my life, and it was early, it was like when I was with Mellencamp, and I might have been 27, coming out of a pretty wild time, party-wise, you know, and suddenly I went, this ain't right. A thing clicked in my head. Now, I'm not saying
I remember what party you were at and what you were looking at to be like, I'm a part of this. I can't judge this.
That's a five-year period, dude. Oh. It ain't one party. The party of 19-something to 19-something. That party, you mean. It was like I was open for business. You know?
Was it something that it was a feeling that was gradually working at you, or just one night, just some boogie night shit happened? You were just like, all right, I got to stop this.
Well, first of all, the environment I was in was just, we were just a bunch of kids in rock bands just partying, and shit was available, you know, and you're drinking, and I had abundance of energy. So, you know, I just, if I drank too much, I wake up the next day, oh, that sucks, and then just go
shake
about my day.
Right.
But what happened was suddenly I started, my stomach started feeling like I couldn't. When I was eating, I was like, wasn't digesting food real good. I just beat myself up. Mm-hmm. I wasn't taking care of myself. And during that time, I was always a jock. I was a three-letter man jock in high school.
What'd you play? Lacrosse.
Ski team and soccer, East Coast shit, you know. Right. And I ended up going to UMass for music, and my freshman year I was on the lacrosse team. That was the number nine lacrosse team in the country.
Was that Amherst or Boston?
Yeah, Amherst.
Oh, God.
And I went there.
There's a party school.
Yeah.
They used to have, like, when I was growing up, once a year somebody died at a party.
Southwest. They'd jump off the building or something?
No, they would ride the elevators.
Oh.
They would ride elevator surfing, and somebody every year would fall down the fucking shaft. Ugh.
Did you go there?
I went to UMass. I went everywhere.
Yeah.
I went everywhere, dude. I went everywhere. I went to UMass Boston.
Yeah.
NC State, Emerson. I was accepted at Northeastern, I think. I can't remember. Yeah. I just sort of bounced around, and I hated school.
Yeah.
I hated it.
Wasn't your thing.
I just didn't give a I just wanted to get the fuck out of there, and I wanted to have fun. I wanted to play drums. I wanted to joke around. I wanted to drink.
Like a normal kid, really.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to do. And there was a few subjects that I would like. Some history, but not that fucking old shit.
Yeah.
And I'm sick.
Yeah, I dig it. I had a purpose in college, so it worked out. But hardcore classical.
I know.
There was no school of rock. Berkeley was still mostly a jazz school. See, in my family, everybody went to college. So, you know, but at that time, it's like you do. So I'll be a music major. And I was self-taught drummer, you know. Mm-hmm. And there was this one kid in Stockbridge. It was getting better. And I was like, man, what are you doing? Well, I'm taking lessons from this percussionist from the Boston Symphony Orchestra, Arthur Press. Lived in, not Nyack. No. He lived in Newton.
Newton, yeah.
Remember Newton?
Yeah.
So, and the first time, so I went, okay, I'm going to take a lesson with this guy, because I was real competitive, you know, just being a jock and all. And but I had long hair down my shoulders, so I was a hippie jock, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and I was always playing in the bands. I was really popular in high school, and I have an identical twin brother. Mm-hmm. So we both were in the bands, both on sports teams. It was
both
like,
had long hair.
Yeah, Heckle and Jekyll.
Did you star in Lethal Weapon at any point? That's all I'm thinking of those two guys with the long blonde hair.
Yeah. So I go down there. I'll never forget. I go down to Newton on a bus, Greyhound bus from Lee. That's it, from Lee. But I was hungover because I had been hanging out with the varsity football team, varsity soccer team, and the cheerleaders the night before, drinking vodka on a mountain. You know, with a fire, just drinking vodka.
A good night.
Yep. And didn't get laid, but, you know, I was hanging with those old, you know, 2 years in high school. That's older chick.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's like big time. They have bigger tits. Everything is more developed, you know. So anyway.
Stakes are higher.
Yeah. So I get to Newton. I'm like hung. I was in the back probably puking in the bus. And I get there. And this is Arthur Press. This is old school. He goes, what's your name? He says, Kenny. Kenny what? Kenny Aronoff. He says, what have you prepared for me today?
Oh, no.
Yeah. What have you put? What? Well, do you play mallets? I'm like, what's mallets? He says, marimba vibes. I said, no. And I'm getting smaller and smaller.
Right.
This is an old school guy, man. This guy's hardcore. Then he goes, well, do you prepare a timpani piece? I said, I don't play timpani. What do you play? I said, well, I play drum set. Well, come on down here. Let's see you play some drum set. Puts on Spinning Wheels by Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Mm-hmm. And I actually been jamming to that in my barn. I had a barn in Western Mass, and that's where we had all our rock bands. My parents let every – we always had the rock bands rehearsing at my place. So I had a barn, and my parents loved it because the kids were at home. Even when we were smoking pot and drinking, they just – there we were, you know.
Right.
So I sit down, and in 30 minutes, he rips me off the – off the drum set and points to a rubber black pad.
Well, how did you feel that you were playing? You're like, oh, wait, spin wheel. I'm going to nail this.
I was feeling it. I thought I was good, but he didn't think so. So he puts me on the pad. Basically, he kicked my ass, and that was a pivotal point in my life. I'm like, a lot of kids would have gone, fuck this, man. I don't need you. I'm playing in a rock band. I'm getting laid. I'm having fun. What do I need this fucking shit? But something clicked, and I have to say it's in my DNA, that this is good for me. And my dad bought me an old set of Vibes for $300 from Carol's Music in New York. Now I had that. And
Do you think your sports background gave you that made you not afraid of, like, oh, new information, this guy's being hard on me? Because this guy seems like a coach to me.
He was totally a coach.
Yeah, you're walking in like the blue chip prospect. Hey, I got this all down. And then he just goes, you don't know shit.
Yeah. He would. No, dude, because back then, you know what I mean, the coaches back then were like Marine sergeants. Back then, there was no hand-holding. There was no coddling. There was no entitlement.
I know.
There was none of this lazy shit.
No, they look at athletes now like they're all a bunch of date rapists and all this. They were frat boys and all that. And they totally lose, like, the confidence that you get from playing sports, the ability to work with a group, the ability to get your fucking ass kicked and lose and shake it off. Like, lose the quarter, win the next quarter.
Yeah.
You learn all this great stuff. But now it's just kind of, you know, it's sort of like the nerd time. So, like, their perspective, and they don't fucking play sports, so their perspective of it is as fucked up, to be fair, as the jock's perspective of them, you know?
Well, you know what? While they're sitting there being entitled and waiting for shit to happen and pussyfooting around, I'm going to go over them and take what they're waiting for.
Yeah,
and I'm sorry, I am not going to back down on that.
That's how it works.
So, I mean, back then, right, you know, it's like my parents were really sensitive and cool, but man... Dude, get your ass up. There was no, you know, hand-holding or entitlement. I'm grateful for that.
Sided with the teacher. If the teacher said your kid's acting like an asshole, they would look at you and be like, what's your problem?
Exactly.
Stop acting like an asshole. Instead of being like, hey, man, you can't say that about my kid.
Exactly.
Take out their cell phone video.
Exactly.
And then the teacher has to apologize because you're not raising your kid right. And now you're dumping this douche off at school, and they have to deal with your bad parenting for 6 hours.
Yeah, exactly.
30 hours a fucking week. I mean, teachers are grossly, grossly underpaid.
Oh, dude, grossly underpaid. Why would you want to be a teacher? It's like you got everybody against you.
Well, not now with all these little fucking kids there, and you do anything, it seems they take out a camera, and then they're automatically right.
Dude, it's brutal, man.
I don't know.
I'll tell you.
We do sound like a bunch of old guys going, oh, my God, he's kids today. But there is an element of, like, Jesus.
You know what? Fuck him.
You know what I miss?
I'm shaking it off.
Shake it off.
Okay, so check this out.
Fuck.
I really believe that people should embrace their fear, their anger, embarrassment, failure, all that negative stuff. I believe you should squeeze it, hug it, throw it away, and get your fucking ass in gear and move forward.
What are some of your top, like, five or whatever, 3, 4, 5 most embarrassing moments that you had on your way up to becoming...
The worst was... So I eventually studied classical music. I got to go to school, so I get into UMass barely. Mm-hmm. I get into UMass barely. But the guy, he put up like some marimba music. I never played marimba. I played vibes. Puts it up, I'm sight reading it, and I suck. I miss every note. He takes it away. No, give it back.
Is the marimba, that's not the Lionel Hampton thing, is it?
That's vibes.
That's vibes.
Marimba's wood and it's long.
Oh, okay.
And you learn classical, like violin music on it, so that you can learn, you know, about harmony and scales, and you become not just a drummer, but you become a well-rounded musician. So I didn't realize this, but when I wrote my book, Sex, Drums, Rock and Roll, I realized I really am a fight-or-flight guy, not a fight-or-flight guy.
Mm-hmm.
That's DNA, you know. So anyway, I demanded that music back, and I just wouldn't give up, and I'm going to love teaching this guy. This guy wants to work. So bottom line is there was this chick there.
Oh, so you bombed on that thing, and he was just like, this isn't right for you, and you...
No, part of your... When you audition for school in classical music, you have to perform on a snare drum. You have a piece you prepare, and then he's going to want to ask you rudiments, technique, and then sight read music.
Mm-hmm.
Same with mallets. You prepare a piece and he's going to say, well, give me a C major scale, give me a D minor scale, give me play an arpeggio, give me an augmented chord, and then and they give you a sheet what they're going to test you on. But then they put that music up that, you know, you've never seen, and you got to play in rhythm and hit all the notes, and I always sucked at that.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I graduated Indiana University, I won a concerto competition where I was shit, I could even play it. It's a violin concerto that I saw Itzhak Perlman play as his encore. Virtuosic, beautiful piece. And I knew in my senior year I was going to have to play a virtuosic violin concerto or violin piece on marimba to pass Indiana. I went from UMass to 4 years at Indiana, which is the number one school. That school, my teacher was like a Navy SEAL commander. It's like he would try to wash you out because the school was number one and had to keep that status. So anybody who was not capable, they would wash you out. He would just, I'm going to get to the embarrassing moment. This guy, I'd walk in and he'd be like, look, taking notes on the last student, and he'd hit the desk, which meant, give me your lesson book. He'd open it up, be still taking notes, he'd look at it and go, oh, F sharp, harmonic, minor, two octaves, start with your right hand, three, four. And I'm still standing there with my book bag. He looks at me and goes, are you happy here at Indiana University, Kenny? Do you want to stay here? I'm like, holy shit.
Jesus
Christ. When you walk in, you get your ass in front of the instrument and be ready to play. You never know when a conductor's going to walk in and say, three, four, let's go. You have to be ready. He was training you to be a Marine. And this stuff carried forward into my entire life. So anyway, I'm at UMass, and there's this hot junior. This chick's talking about cellist. It's as hot as you can be in classical music. It's not like rock and roll. But anyway, she was the hottest.
She was classical hot.
Classical hot. So I hear
she had a powdered wig. Nice tits and a powdered wig. All right.
So I hear that she's going to go to this place called Aspen School of Music. It's run by Juilliard. Mm-hmm. So all I'm thinking is chick, you know, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to go. I got to go. I don't realize it's run by Juilliard, which is the number two school in the country. And it's I'm not going to get in. So, but the sheet of, they tell you got to prepare in the audition from three out of the four different areas: snare drum, timpani, mallets, and multiple percussion. So I audition on all four because I'm not that great yet. So the pieces are, you know, kind of like beginner, intermediate.
Right.
I send the tape in. No, I don't hear from them. Last day of school, I got my dad's station wagon. I'm going to leave UMass. So my summer was to study with Arthur Press. I had this cool band, Allman Brothers Band, and I had this girlfriend that didn't know about the cellist. But anyway, I'm leaving Amherst, and I went, oh, shit, I forgot to check my mail. I go back, and I told the mail, I had some mail, and it looks like I got a check. And I went, oh, shit, what's this? I open up, accepted to Aspen 2 weeks before.
No way.
So it must have been somebody must have canceled, because you don't tell somebody 2 weeks before.
Right.
So 2 weeks later, I go to Aspen. By the way, the chick didn't show up. She didn't go.
Oh, the classical chick.
She did not go. So I'm there. Dude, I was.
So you went to the two worst, to none.
Worst percussionist there. All these kids were Juilliard prep. They'd been playing timpani marimba when they were in diapers. You know, they were just, I'm doing scales. And they're going playing these Bach partitas and virtuosic shit. I have a picture of me with all those people, and the funny thing is, it's kind of like your story. Worst guy there, I became the most, I mean, as far as famous visual guy out of all of them. Some became lawyers, some became this, came that. One guy did get a timpani job in the San Francisco Orchestra, which is big, but nobody became visible and a rock star like me. I'm not saying I'm better. I'm just saying it's just ironic. I thought when I was there, I was a piece of shit because, okay, one day I'm in rehearsal. Orchestra rehearsal. We're playing a Tchaikovsky symphony or something, or Romeo and Juliet. And the orchestra is going, and then they stop and the cymbals go,
right.
It's a hole for me. Well, I'm counting. I didn't know what I should have done is study the music and just pretty much memorize eight measures before you come in. So you don't have to count. You don't have to worry about counting. The violins do, not me. I'm going 100, 102, 103, 104, or one, wait, what is it? Wait, 100, 100, 1, 2, 3, 4, 101, 3, 4, 102. 102 3, I'm up to 4. 300. I'm like, was that 101 or was that 102?
Oh, fuck,
I'm fucked. I come in the wrong place. This motherfucker, he didn't just go, excuse me. He went, who's playing cymbals? The whole orchestra turns around. I'm peeing in my pants. And it's like, me, embarrassed, and he says, don't you know when to come in? Count for me. Okay, so I start counting. I count like 200 measures. He's just trying to ridicule me. He was an asshole. And I get to the point where I'm supposed to come in and I don't play. He says, why didn't you play? I said, you said count. He didn't say play. Oh,
Jesus. This reminds me of that fucking, what was that movie where the guy was playing the drums?
Whiplash.
Yeah, and the guy kept yelling. Totally. I couldn't watch the movie.
Yeah.
I was just like, just join a different band. Why would you sit here and let somebody, if I've had a kid, let somebody talk to him to that level.
I know.
It's like one thing of just trying to make you better, but like when it gets to the point somebody's like taking their life out on you, you know, or at least push back.
Yeah.
You know, why don't you go fuck yourself? Get one of those.
Yeah, I know.
He'll respect you more instead of sitting there. I don't know. That kind of goes against what we've been talking about earlier, where we were saying, like, you know, you got to take a little bit.
There's both. There's both. You know, it's a scale. It's always a scale. What weighs heavier? Me punching him in the face or verbally telling him and then get my ass kicked and fired? Is that more important than hanging in here and just getting better?
Right.
You make a decision. It's always a scale to me. You know, it's like the coach that's up your ass, or the teacher in many cases, or some of the people I've worked for. And you go, you know, I remember people telling me, I won't mention names, and say, I can't believe you put up with that shit. And I'm like, well, number one hit single on the radio right now. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's like.
You didn't go on the road with them. It was just a studio gig?
No, it was full blown.
Oh, on the road.
Whole thing. Yeah.
And, you know, I've been so fucking lucky in this business. And I also think it's because when I finally started doing shit in this business, where, like, it used to be back in the day, there was, like, 20 giant slices of pie.
Yeah.
And so there was always sort of, like, 20 people at any moment who just could snap their fingers and the whole world had to move.
Yeah.
And now it just seems like each one of those 20 slices has been chopped up a million times. So it's like you can't be an asshole anymore.
I know.
You know what I mean?
Oh,
you sort of, like, can't be that, you know, tipping over the craft service table and I refuse to come out of my trailer until
this. Are you telling me that my career is over since we've been talking?
No, no.
I've said enough shit to get me banned.
No, I've definitely, like, but I've never on any acting gig, everybody I've ever worked with, they always showed up on time.
Yeah.
And you hear all these stories. I've only been doing that stuff for like the last few years, but I've never run into that. But then you always heard these stories. You know, I first got into this business about, you know, people would get like a sitcom and then all of a sudden the creators of the show are banned from the set.
Yeah.
And they refuse to do the lines. They're tanking table reads. Because they're mad at the writers, all of that shit. Yeah, I never saw any of that.
Well, that's because now there's somebody sitting, there's 100 people behind you ready to take your gig for a third of the pay.
Yeah.
In rock and roll? I hear it say, you want to go on tour, I won't mention your name, some chick's doing stadiums and they're paying the musicians that.
I've heard about that.
Are you kidding me? I said, I used to make that in a day recording. I used to. And the thing is that there's kids that will go out and do it for half as much and share a room or sleep on the floor just to do it.
It's unbelievable. I had a friend of mine tell me about that, doing like some giant, like,
stadium.
Say like where the Falcons are playing.
Yeah.
And he was just going, dude, if you knew the money that we were making, it's just like the artist gets all of it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we're going back. I'm sleeping in the bathtub. This other guy's sleeping in the bed and blah, blah, blah. And it's just,
What happens, the accountants got control of the business. The accountants and the business people. And where the artists thought, they suck up to the artists. The artists are happy because you're saving money. I'm saving you this amount of money if you put these people there and you pay them this and you're this and you're that. And, you know, that'll give anybody a hard on, you know, especially if you were a struggling musician. There's a point in the fork in the road where I think a struggling musician either becomes the person that was kind of keeping them down, or they go, that's not the way to treat people.
Right.
And most of them don't. They become just like that or worse. I've worked with these guys where, you know, they got screwed. Yeah, they got screwed by the label. They got screwed, like, by managers. They got screwed, yeah. But that doesn't mean you screw your band.
I saw a guy recently. I was watching one of these called Sideman.
And there was did something in that.
There's a guy in that. And
these are the Black Blues guys.
No. This is just talking about Hired Gun. Like a Hired Gun.
I'm in Hired Gun.
Yeah, yeah. Like exactly what you're doing. Right. Okay, so this guy, Basically,
which guy was that in that one? What's the story?
All right, it was the Nine Inch Nails
band. Oh, I know all those guys. I know both sides.
So there was a guy.
Yeah, I know.
In that band,
he becomes the guy that was treating him a certain way. He went and became that guy.
Yeah, Trent goes, "Hey, man," he goes, "You're going home to a giant house. The end of this tour, I'm going back to live with my parents." He goes,
"In the basement."
Yeah, and he goes, "You want to make some money? Write a record." So he went out and he wrote a record. And then he turned around and he did the exact same thing to all those people. I thought he would have eased off the gas a little bit. You know what I mean? He's just like, "Nah, fuck you, man. This is the game. So I watched it. I didn't know how to feel about it. Like, I was sitting there going like, well, I wouldn't do that shit. But it's easy for me as a comedian because, you know, we don't have to split the money as far as with like other band members.
Yeah.
You know, it's just all the other shit, taxes and all
that.
Well,
I mean, to defend him or that position is that's – the business could make you feel like, you know, I got just beat up so much that now it's my turn to be on top and fuck everybody else, that kind of thing. It can do that, but
there was a time like that in stand up. It was a certain comedy club, and it was just a really bad time for it, and it just had this really negative vibe. And there was all of these guys that at the time had TV shows and movie careers, and they would come down to the club. And they would do like an hour and a half, 2 hours, not worked out any material, just leaning on the mic stand, going, "Yeah, so what else is going on?" And just showing off that they could burn the light. And meanwhile, would bump like 20 comics and like people would just start saying, you know, and then you couldn't say, "I'm going home," because then the club would get mad at you. So you would literally go from having like an 11 o'clock spot to waiting around to like 2:30 in the morning. There would be nobody there. And this was every fucking night, and you felt that energy in the back of the club of certain comics being like, "Man, I can't wait till I get a fucking sitcom. I'm going up there and I'm gonna fucking burn the light. I'm gonna make everybody else wait." And fortunately, right around that time, the Seinfeld show was ending, and I would never forget, I was down the Improv on Melrose, and Jerry Seinfeld came in to do a set, and he had to do 20 minutes, and he did 20 minutes. He came up with shit that worked. And then in the middle, he tried out some new stuff, had a big closer, and then he just went around, "Hey, any questions?" Bing, bang, boom, and done. And walked
in
off.
In that same club that you would
no,
do this shit?
No, this was a different
club. That's a great example.
That's what I was sitting in, and I remember, and then wanting them, "Oh, don't leave, you know, leave him wanting more," all of that shit.
Oh,
and I was
dude,
just like,
that's
dude, he was
pro.
Total fucking pro. And I just remember thinking, like, that's how you do it. That's how you do it. And
good thing you were there.
And every comic, like, who watched left excited that they got to see him work and do his thing. And then you don't give a shit if you get bumped 20 minutes to see Seinfeld.
Yeah.
But, you know, if he went up there and for fucking 2 hours.
Yeah, tortured everybody.
Was meandering, you know, had a little fucking piece of, you know, just going up there being famous, just to be famous. And the fact that he didn't do that, that always stuck with me. I'm like, all right, that's how you
fucking
do it.
That's what you aspire to be, that classy and that professional. That's the shit.
Okay, time for some reads here. All right, Sunbasket, everyone. All right, my health-seeking friends, the days of not following through with resolutions are over, because the days of Sunbasket are just beginning, which means you're going to keep your resolution this year, you fat bastard, because Sunbasket makes it easier than ever. And today, you can get $35 off your first order when you go to sunbasket.com/burr, B-U-R-R. When you have healthy meals regularly delivered to your door with Sunbasket and you don't eat ice cream afterwards, you're going to drop the weight. It's easy to stay on track. I'm talking about ingredients like organic produce, responsibly raised meat. Hey, it's past your bedtime. Get back in the bar. Sustainably sourced, sorry, my daughter's laughing at me. Sustainably sourced fish, organic pasture raised eggs, organic non-GMO tofu. Oh, and the house-made sauces you can't find anywhere else. And it's all personalized. Sunbasket lets you mix and match from paleo, lean and clean, gluten-free, vegan, vegetarian, Mediterranean, and more. Sorry, I got my Invisalign in. Not to mention tons of variety. With 18 recipes to choose from, best of all, each delicious, easy recipe is ready in about 30 minutes. I gave you more. Here, there's more right there. Go to sunbasket.com/burr today to learn more and get $35 off your first order. That's sunbasket.com/burr for $35 off. sunbasket.com/burr. Okay, movement watches, everybody. You guys have heard me talk about movement. You know who's, you know those two college dropouts? You didn't eat all of that. It's right here. It's right there. There you go. You know those two college dropouts that started their own watch company? This company has grown like crazy, and now almost 2 million watches sold in 160 countries. They continue to revolutionize the fashion world. You got it right here. You got it right somewhere right there. In the countries to revolutionize the fashion on belief that style shouldn't break the bank, buddy. I don't know if you've checked the site out lately, but they have doubled the number of watch styles and are still expanding. Movement watches start at just $95. Good Lord. Here. Movement figured out that by selling online, they were able to cut out the middleman and retail markup at the best for the best possible price. Classic design, quality construction, and styled minimalism. Get 15% off today. You liked that part, didn't you? With free shipping and free returns, go to movementwatches.com/burr. See why the movement keeps growing. Check out their expanding collection. Go to mvmt.com/burr. Join. Okay, and lastly, but certainly not leastly, LegalZoom, man. National Small Business Month at LegalZoom is here. Hi, hi. Whether you're just starting out or already have a business, there's a lot you can take advantage of right now. Just go to LegalZoom.com/startup during March Match to download your free business startup kit. You'll get a ton of great information. For example, you can find out how to maximize your business deductibles under the new tax laws. Plus, you'll get great discounts. Your kit includes special deals from LegalZoom along with their service partners, so you can save a bunch of money financing, marketing, and operating your business. LegalZoom isn't a law firm, but they know you need to tap into the right resources to run a successful business. That's why their business startup kit, that's what their business startup kit is all about. Go to LegalZoom.com/startup to download your free business startup kit today. There's no obligation, just free business sources. This offer is only available in March. So if you're listening after then, you can still enjoy special savings by using the code BURR, B-U-R-R, when you check out at LegalZoom.com. Well, tell me, what are you doing to work out, dude? You're like shredded.
Well, I have a gym in my house, and okay, what do I do? Okay, so I lift weights. I have 8 steps to health.
You got another book about this? I haven't even mentioned your book. Sex, Drums, and Rock and Roll is his book. The hardest hitting man in show business, Kenny Aronoff.
I left that out of the book. That's why I'm writing a second book. They cut 300 pages out of that book. I mean, I'm on 300 million records sold, dude.
So I'm
just a workaholic, you know, and so they said, it's too long. The magic number is 325 pages. I went, they left out this whole scene with me and Cameron Diaz, me meeting Dave Grohl when he comes up to me and I'm hungover. I just played with the Buddy Rich Big Band in New York. Me and Matt Sorum were out all night just partying it up. And I'm hungover checking out, and skinny Dave Grohl comes up to me and goes, "Hey, Kenny, it's Dave. What are you doing?" I said, "Hi, Dave. Yeah, I'm flying home. I'm a little hungover." He says, you got to stay in town. I got this showcase tonight. You got to come." He's jumping around like a jackrabbit. And he says, "I got a new band, man." I says, "Oh, cool, man." I said, "What's the name of it?" He goes, it's Foo Fighters, man." I'm like, "God, that's a weird name. See ya." That didn't make the book.
Wow.
They said, "You're just name dropping, man." They said, "You can't have..." I have to admit.
Yeah, but nerds like me, I want to hear those stories.
It's Cameron Diaz you're like, too. It was basically I turned, you know, I didn't, it's, you know, the Sunset Marquee. Remember the Whiskey Bar?
The Whiskey
Bar? Whiskey Bar and the Sunset Marquee Hotel. It's the bar in the Sunset Marquee. You know, that's the hotel. It's a kind of a boutique hotel where all the rockers go. If you're on Alta Loma, go down the hill off of Sunset. It's in there.
Okay.
And it was, you walk in there, it'd be Jeff Beck, it'd be U2, it'd be the Stones. It was, and only could hold 75 people. It was really intimate. All the rock bands would stay there. So I'm staying there, and I'm doing a record with Tony Iommi and Billy Corgan from the Pumpkins.
Wow.
Tony Iommi from Sabbath. So doing a solo record, And those that was a 13-hour session that one day with 45-minute break.
You know, Jesus
this
Christ.
Is a, this is to be a real badass session. And, you know, no vocals to listen to. It was just we were writing the song right there, three movements, and Billy doesn't fuck around. It's not a party time. It's fucking all work. So that night I'm sitting in there having a drink with Tony, and a whole bunch of shit happened that night. I think that might be in the book, but I also see Toby Myers. I just left the Mellencamp band 2 years prior, and I've been in that band for 17 years. So it was like a divorce. Also, I see the bass player come running out of the bar. I'm in the lobby because it was too filled, and he's like, "Fuck this!" and he's pissed. I'm like, "Toby, what's going on, man?" He says, "Oh, fuck!" And he gets in the elevator, takes off. I'm like, "Wow, what's going on?" I walk in there, and there's the Mellencamp band. So that was kind of an emotional.
Yeah, it's been almost 2 decades.
It's like a divorce and seeing your ex-wife suddenly. Mm-hmm. And the new drummer, you know, and it's awkward, you know. Then I look over out in the courtyard, and there's the tour manager for the Pumpkins, about 6'8". And he brings me over. The bottom line is, he's smiling. He just wanted to see what it'd be like. I saw Cameron Diaz there. She'd just done that big first movie, Something About Mary. Mm-hmm. And some guy's talking to her. And the bottom line is, it was Jimmy Chamberlain, a drummer from the Pumpkins. He wanted to see us connect, you know, meet, what would happen.
Right.
Anyway, he's had some drinks and stuff, and he's just talking to her. And I was just so uptight from this, everything going on that day, and then the Mellencamp band, and like, you know. And bottom line is, Jimmy and I, he tapped on Jimmy. Jimmy and I just kind of talked, but it didn't work out the way I wanted to. So I stood there and I went, that's not how I want to meet Jimmy Chamberlain. I cooled down, went, tapped him on the shoulder and said, Jimmy, listen, man, I respect you so much. You are one of my favorite drummers, badass. I feel so honored to be playing in your band. Dude, I just, God damn. I'm sorry I met you like this. And, you know, I would love to just tell you how much I appreciate you. And then I walked off. It's about 2 in the morning. The bar closes. Out comes Cameron Diaz, lands on my lap.
Jesus Christ.
Puts your arms around me. Lands on my lap. Now, I'm 1998, so I was like just a ball of testosterone. And my normal game of play was like, if a chick lands on your lap at 2 in the morning, what do you think you're going to say or do, right?
It's a good sign.
But this is Cameron Diaz, gorgeous, hot. And she whispers, you know, with that smile on those lips, and she whispers in my ear. Somebody would have probably thought she was kissing me. Whispers in my ear, says, you know, I heard what you said to Jimmy. That was really, really cool. And I look at her, I smile, and that's usually when I go, hey, I got a room upstairs. I can get some liquor. You want to eat? You want some? What do you want?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I put my move. I didn't put that in the book. They said, well, you didn't have sex with her. I'm like, the reason why I should have put that in my book is this. The reason why I didn't say anything to her, which was not normal for me, was I had a fucking session the next day, 13 hours with Billy Corgan and Tony Iommi.
Oh,
and,
fuck!
No, and the point of this book is work came over everything.
Well, if you turned down the potential of that,
you're definitely a workaholic.
The reason why I'm saying this is I'm hoping Cameron Diaz like come finds me someday while I'm giving one of my speeches on stage and says, I'm here to collect.
Yeah.
We'll probably be in wheelchairs and have colostomy bags, and I'll be, not so much now.
Hey, do you...
talking about working out.
Yeah, what about diet and all that?
All right, so in the book, I came up with 8 things. First thing, number one, lifting weights. The reason why lifting weights is important...
Swore off it because I fucked up my rotator cuff, so please tell me.
There's other types of lifting weights. You can do...
The pink ones? Those little one-pounders? I think I can handle those at this point.
300 reps.
300 reps, okay.
300 reps.
Get that wiry strength.
Yeah, there's all kinds of things. I have bands when I go on the road to take in my hotel room. I can do everything in my hotel room. So anyway, lifting weights, besides being strong, it keeps your hormone levels up. And when your hormone levels up, you're fighting the big three diseases, cancer, diabetes, and heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
It's proven. So our hormone levels go down real quick. You know, it's before you're... Definitely near 20, shit starts changing. Testosterone levels start going down after 18 or 17 or something. It's crazy. But anyway, it keeps your hormone levels up, which makes you younger, too. Everything about it makes you youthful. All right. So lifting weights does that. It also, the more muscle mass you build, the more it chews on fat. Right. It eats your fat. Okay. So, you know, and I know how to carve my body. I know that, you know, you do, you know, bench press for your chest. You do, you know, you do pull, you know, you pull downs to get, to create that V. You do, you know, I do bench also to build your chest. Fly, I do flies and bench. I know how to carve my body. All right. The second thing is cardio.
I'm just picturing your gym. Do you have like that shit from like the 80s? That old, what was it, the Weider, Weider things, the AMF and all of that? I'm picturing this old thing. The gray on gray. Remember the gray on gray sweatsuit?
I used to work in gyms like that in Indiana. It was an old school gym. With Olympians would work in there. It was like called the Iron Pit.
Yeah.
There was nothing pretty about it. These are guys that want to work out, you know.
Right.
But I had a trainer for a long time. So I lived for 14 years. So I learned how to do it right. And I need to get a new one because I need to be, you know, get the latest techniques, you know. It's all about technique, as you well know. Rotator cuff. You know, people don't, you know.
I can help you with bad technique.
Yeah.
If you want to get hurt, I can fucking, I've gone three injuries in a row and now I think I'm fine.
Well, you know, when you bench pressed, did you, or do you, when you did any weights, you used to probably raise your shoulders, right?
My shoulders were already up.
Okay. The thing about lifting weights is you
two
isolate.
Years of trauma. I was in a protective posture.
Dude,
told you, I had fucking orange hair when I was growing up. I mean, I was just goddamn bullseye.
Yeah, you were a bullseye. Yeah. You know, fuck this white shit. You know, my twin brother's a shrink. You go see him. He'll help you out.
I'm done talking to those fucking people.
Yeah, I know.
Because you're always going to have problems, and then they always got to sit there and then you start doing it to other people. Oh, you know what that is? That's because when you were a kid and that ice cream fell off your fucking cone, and then you just become this person trying to connect everything. So
I know I do. I've
just sort of accepted who I am. I try to work on being less of an angry asshole.
Yeah,
is what I'm trying to do. I've gotten way better. I feel
you're married, right?
Yeah,
yeah. How's she dealing with it? Angry asshole.
Nah, she's a
angry asshole too.
Nah, she's a saint, man.
You did good.
No, if she ever just said, "Look, I just can't fucking deal with you anymore," I would be heartbroken. I get it.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah,
right. I get it.
Yep.
But I mean, you know, then there's the other part of me. It's just like, well, you know, we're living nice here.
Yeah,
and I'm out here every fucking goddamn every other weekend, and I start getting mad again. You know, I'm out here fucking Dayton, Ohio.
Yeah.
Doing shit and dick jokes. Well, you're watching every episode of The Office.
Exactly.
Yeah, you start getting like that, which doesn't get you anywhere.
Feels good for a second.
I gave up arguing with my wife for Lent, and I'm finding the genius. I used to think those guys were just like they just quit. We're just those guys. It's not worth it. It's not worth it. It is actually there's the game within the game when you do that. It's because.
Oh, yeah, man, that's heavy. If you can do that because your emotions are raging, your brain isn't as powerful as your emotions.
But their thing is how they get you, okay?
Oh, well,
they can't physically beat the shit, generally speaking, unless you're dating some UFC chick. Like, they can't beat the fuck out of you.
Oh, I know.
So they have to go cerebral. And what happens is you give up all your information when you're wrong. When you're mad.
Yeah,
and then
mad.
They collect that shit.
Oh, yeah.
So the thing is when you don't lose your shit anymore, all of a sudden, they're the information trail, the cord has been cut. Now they don't know what the fuck you're thinking.
I love it.
And there's just like this, holy shit, I think I finally got some power back in this. This is incredible. So
the big thing is you recognize that.
Yeah.
That's the big thing. Because what I'm doing now is like.
It's the execution that's
fucking
me up.
You. Oh, wait a minute. Don't say that. Don't say anything. Yeah, you start getting smart. You go, you start to learn how to be tactical like them.
It freaks them out.
Oh, dude.
Because all of a sudden.
But they respect you, though.
Yeah,
more.
But they don't like. But then what they do is then all you did was catch up to one of their skill sets.
Yeah, one of the. Yeah.
And then what happens is then, you know, they immediately start adjusting their game. It becomes a different. It's evolving.
They're professional at what they do, and we're just learning how to do it.
Yeah,
so they're better.
Yeah.
It's like getting the ring with Muhammad Ali. I mean, you might get one punch in, then it's lights out.
Yeah.
You know, you know what my big thing is now?
That is my experience.
Yeah. My big thing now is try this. As I know there's that point where I can feel the fucking testosterone blowing in through me, my muscles swelling, and she's had a couple glasses of wine. She's like completely out of control, and I'm perfect. And
right.
She, I just go, there's that one moment, I just go, see ya. I shut the computer or the book or whatever I'm doing. I say, see ya, and I leave. I pull myself out of the room.
Oh, you can walk?
Oh, I got to walk. Because if I don't...
I've always wanted to do the walk. I've never been able to do it.
No, do the walk. Just say, you know what? I'll see you. I'm going. Or just leave. Say, I'm done. That's what I say. I'm done. I leave. Because if I don't...
I got to do the clap.
Yeah.
I like the clap. I'm done.
I'm done.
Scene.
See ya. Now, but that's good for both of us. Because what happens if... See, I'll be up all night stewing about it. Not her. She goes to sleep, wakes up. Oh, next morning, hey, honey. And I'm like still raging.
Right.
I can't get past that. I wish I could start going into, Jesus Christ, man. Oh, fuck, what am I doing here? What this is.
Oh, I talked to myself. Yeah. I walked down the street one time and I didn't even give a shit who heard me. And I know there was people looking at me. I didn't care. I was just like,
he's practicing.
I was just like, I will never do this again.
Yeah.
Okay. I understand people getting married the first time. You didn't know what you were getting into. But people who get the second time, it's like you got three. Oh my God.
Check this.
I am fucking one and done. If this shit doesn't work, I'm not saying we're in a bad place, but if she ever just said, fuck this, I'm out, I would totally get it. And I would give her everything.
Yeah.
And I would have somebody build me this.
The drum room?
No, the dream divorcee house for a guy, which is just a garage with the fucking room above it.
Yeah.
And it's a big studio. Yeah. I'll have electronic drum kits. So I don't piss anybody off. I'll have all the fucking sports packages, a little kegerator, slowly drink myself to death, and a nice car, nice my old fucking 68 F-100. And you want everything fucking thing else, take it. I don't give a shit.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I feel the same way. If my wife, she's 21 years younger, you know, she's hot as hell, Gina. If she left me, I tell her, you don't have to worry about me cheating on you, because if you leave me, I'm done. I will never fucking live with another woman again. And, you know, and rightfully so, a strike three, you're out. I mean, I'd be like, now I'm not saying I'm not going to date and do what guys do, but I would live alone. You don't deserve to live with anybody. It's, you know, I'll take half the blame.
I'm not
good enough. I'm not equipped for this. Next life, I'll do it. Right now, because you know, my career has always been first. I mean,
is that what messed up?
Most everything. It's always been my career's been first, and we can attach that to all kinds of Freudian shit. I don't give a fuck. Career's always been first, and that's what got me where I am. And now I'm.
That's what I love about my wife is she gets that. Because I've seen other guys deal with that where it's just like they get with somebody and they love the lifestyle of what you do. But then they want that 9-to-5 guy who's going to be like, honey, I'm home every night. And after a while, they just get tired of that. And then that's what fucking makes me paranoid about women is because then they leave you, but they take the lifestyle with them. And you're the guy that earned it. And now you have to continue going out doing what the fuck it is you do while you give all the lifestyle money to them. And then they meet this other fucking 9-to-5 asshole and they get to live this rock star shit and you know, cake and eat it.
Yeah.
Cake and eat it.
That's the reality. Yeah. That's a definite.
That is a definite reality. And if you bring that up, it's considered like misogynistic and all that type of shit, that's the thing that all of this Me Too shit that's going on right now, where they're examining the male-female dynamic, which obviously needs to be done. It's obviously a good thing to – I mean, I had no idea all this fucking shit was going on.
Oh, so well, cool.
That's all good. But what I love about this is like we're going to examine the male-female dynamic, but it's they're only going to critique what guys do in the relationship. So at that point, you're kind of suggesting that women are like these completed works. And meanwhile, they're fucking killing us. Every guy dies before their wife. They always outlive us. They blame us. Hey, you don't go to the fucking doctor. You know, I'm going to the doctor. I'm going. I'm getting everything fucking checked out. I'm going to just to fucking prove them wrong. My wife's still going to kill me. I swear to God she is. I'll go there.
You know what I tell my wife?
I have all my shut.
I tell everyone I'm going to live longer than all you fuckers. I got that old man
no,
shit.
No, you
got
to do that.
I'm going to fucking live. I'm just I'll be hanging
out of
on.
Stubbornness.
I'm going to hang on, you know. Hey, you fucker. You know, I'll be paralyzed on one side. I mean, you can't kill me.
Communicating through your little bell like that dude in Breaking Bad.
Yeah, exactly. I know. It's pretty crazy. I mean, you know, it's just typical of anything like this. It swings way over to the other side. And there's definitely some Definitely some issues and things to be addressed. I mean, without mentioning names, bad behavior is bad behavior. Yeah. I agree. Bad behavior is bad behavior. But this, it gets to the point where then you've got so many gray areas and so many things to consider that aren't just what's going on in the news. It's not just there's something else going on, and they're trying to like just put it all into one little cubicle. I'm going to get my ass kicked for this, but you know it's not.
I don't want you to get in trouble here. I don't want you to go.
Don't worry. You're not getting me in trouble.
Let me ask you this: what do you think music today? What are some of the bands you like? Everybody's always trash. Oh my god, what happened to music? And blah 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 blah. What are you liking music this day?
I think mediocrity is in.
And do you think part of that was because all the studios, they used to have like the fucking guy you wanted to produce your record, and now it's like it's just fucking people at home.
No, it's real simple. Well, you're right, but the reason behind all the change, or one of the big reasons behind the change, is that you don't buy CDs. There's no income coming in. I'm on three CDs that sold 40 million a piece. Mm-hmm. Two Celine Dion records and a Meatloaf, Bad Out of Hell 2. Each sold over 40 million, not including downloads. Think about now if the artist is making 18 cents on the dollar. That's 82 cents to the label times 40 mil. That's going to pay some bills. The business model was, when I was with Mellencamp, we could spend a year making a record. You know, of course, we were doing it in Indiana, which was cheaper, but actually we did it in other places. But we could spend a year working on a record. If we made a record and the music sucked, you'd throw it away and start again. And also, by the way, back then, if you didn't have a good chorus, a good hook line, a unique sound, unique this, unique that, you wouldn't even get played on the radio because everybody else was doing that. You were competing against the greatest records that have come out in a long time.
Right.
And so, but there was money. That's my point. And when the record came out, there was $1 million you could invest if they wanted to. $1 million to get that record played on the radio across the United States. Not to mention the marketing plan for the Europe and in Asia and England and Australia. Then when you went on tour, there was tour support. There was money to invest in a band to build a career. And the way – there's nothing more powerful than a bunch of guys working together. Let's see. Beatles, Stones, U2, you know, The Who. I mean, these bands – Led Zeppelin. I mean, these bands work together. Didn't even matter if they got along. The point is all the talent in one room created – this incredible team that created incredible, epic product. Right. One guy can't do what four guys. That's like Michael Jordan was the most dangerous basketball player in the world. Why? He figured it out. It wasn't about him. It was about the team. And that's what scared the other people on the other side.
Yeah, I remember the coach of the Pistons saying that one year when Mike showed up, the first game they played him, they collapsed the D on him and he passed the ball and he went like, oh, shit.
Of course.
He still dominated and took over the game, but once he started doing that, he added that whole dynamic to his game and it was over.
His point is, you look at him, you know he's going to do the right thing for the team. That's scary, man, because that means he's a coach and a player. So, I mean, the teams are greater than individuals. One guy thinks that he can do as much as five. That's crazy. But because of the budgets, we've been forced into those cubicles. We've been forced to – people have to – there is no budget. I have a studio right up the road there, and people come over, and they want me to record drums. I have an engineer. I have a control room and a drum room. And I've done like Sammy Hagar, Billy Gibbons, Steve Lukather, all kinds of – but most of the work I get is people sending me files from all over the world. And they save up their little money, and they have – you know, 44 decades of experience. And my
sound. So they'll literally write a song and be like, I want to get Kenny Aaron up on this. And I send you a little zip, whatever the fuck they call it, zip vibe, or zip file.
File.
Call it, or zip recruiter, whatever the fuck they call it. They send you that thing.
Yeah. I load it into my Pro Tool. So I ask for this. I ask for the click they used on the session because, man, the times I haven't gotten a click, it's a disaster. If they didn't play to a click track,
oh, shit.
We're fucked.
And it's speeding up and slowing
down.
And
it takes me longer. So because of the budget, I want...
I would love to see you in your drum room. Jesus fucking Christ. Yeah. He's slowing down again.
Something like that.
Wow.
So I get the click. I want the click they use in the session. I put that into Pro Tools on one track. And I can control the volume. Then I tell them to send me the demo with the drum sequences, stuff that they used. Because 9 out of 10 times, that's what they're in love with. Then send me the song without the drums, because that's what I'm going to play to. I'm going to play to the song without the drum sequence and the click.
Do you before, you know, you play what they already put down?
Oh,
do you play what you would play first?
I do that.
So
no.
You don't have their shit in your head?
No, I play. First I do is I play exactly what they program. Mm-hmm. Then I start making adjustments. Like instead of open hi-hat, I might go to the crash cymbal or go to the ride cymbal. Or the first take, I give them three takes. First take is pretty much what they had, but it's with my feel. And then I start doing like more fills that are me. I do different things that I'm thinking they could pick from this. And in the third take, I go even further. And that's my really my definition of creativity is to start with the foundation and then build off of that. And sometimes I'll give four takes if I think, you know what? And then I send it back to them, and they typically go for take two. The three is I've gone too far, or they might grab – like he was doing the song for Sammy Hagar, and I said, you know, I really think this song – he just sent me guitar and his vocal and a click.
He can still sing his ass
ridiculous.
Off.
I just so played
crazy.
With him. Just here in ridiculous. He's like one of the
Let me know next time you guys are playing.
I'd dude, this was like, I was playing with him, the guys from Stone Temple Pilots, some guys from the Colts, some guys from Matt Sorum and I were playing together. Steve Stevens. I mean, somebody from the Stones. It was great. It was a music thing. I mean, to get kids, you know, instruments in schools. But
I thought you were describing what all you guys are doing. It was a music thing. Oh, yeah. I didn't think you guys were playing basketball, man.
That's why I had to clarify that.
Yeah. So anyways, I got it. That was really interesting. So they usually end up taking, like, take two, which makes sense because they're not drummers. And then you but they know what they want. And then
you should see. I got to show you what my charts. I'm the most anal chart writer in the planet. This is because,
Hey, while you look for that, I want to ask a question.
Yeah.
That I've drummer for the longest fucking time. I've always wanted to ask a drummer with your setup. I don't know if you still do this.
Yeah, I do. It's reversed.
Yeah. Why do you, for people at home listening, he would have like, whatever.
12 inch to 10 inch.
10 inch going, and you're a right-handed drummer going left to right. Wow. Look
it's
at that.
30 minutes. Takes me to that. And then I read it and make it sound like I'm not reading. Make it feel like I'm not reading.
I'm looking at his drum shot. Oh, that is so fucking cool.
It's like Chinese, right?
Yeah. Usually for people who don't play drums listening to this, you go, high to low. So you like 10, 12, 14, 16 going down, and you go like 12, 10.
16, 18.
16, 18.
So what happened was I got in the Mellencamp band, and I when I auditioned, I showed up with a car with leaky oil, and I had this big ass, you know, Neil Peart from Rush drum set. John looks at me, looks at the car, looks at the drums, shakes my hand. John Mellencamp turns around and walks the other direction like, wow, he was not happy. I didn't look cool. The car's leaking on his driveway, and I got a drum set that's like, you know, he's not cool. He says, this guy's not going to work out. I crushed it, though. I just beat the shit. I broke everything. He was this close to me. His mouth was open like, holy shit, this guy's into it. Anyway, I get in the band, but immediately said, all right,
so that was another time when someone's just look at you like no, and you just went over the top. That's fucking awesome.
In that book, you see where he cut me from the first record 5 weeks later, and he told me to go home. And I said, "No, I ain't going home. I'm not fucking going home. There's no way. I was going to be mortified. I'd rather go to Mars. There's no way I'm going to go home." See, I didn't have enough. I didn't know how to serve a song. You know what I tell a drummer? And we'll get back to the 10-inch Dom. I say, you know what the purpose of a drummer is when you're making a record? Nobody ever gets it. They're going to get it now because I've said it enough, but they go, beat? I'm like, yeah. Time? I says, no. Get the fucking song on the radio to be number one. That's your job. Because when you do that, you just made the company millions of dollars. You just made the record label. You made the artist or the band millions of dollars. If Microsoft hired us, they don't give a fuck about us. They just want us to make money, and they smile. And when we make money for them, they give us some money. We take care of our family. It's that simple. And then nobody ever tells you that shit. But that's why I didn't get on the first record. I played with Leonard Bernstein. I was at Tanglewood. I got in the Jerusalem Symphony Orchestra. What the fuck does that have to do with getting a song on the radio to be number one? I didn't know. I was looking through a telescope, and that is looking through a microscope. Mm-hmm. Where you, it's a different direction, isn't it? And I didn't understand that. And I eventually did, obviously. But I'm a fight or flight guy. I didn't know that until I wrote this book. I thought I'm just this nice.
I can't wait to read this. Okay. I can't wait to read this.
Well,
please tell me though. I don't want to get
so
away with
that. So here's what happened. So John said I he liked Charlie Watts. He wanted the Charlie Watts. One rack tom, one floor tom.
Mm-hmm.
One ride cymbal, one crash and a hi-hat. That's it. So that was really tough because, you know, drummers are really particular about their setup. So I went, all right. I was really pissed about that, but okay. I did it. And then we went on tour. Let's see. Maybe I did the first tour with one rack tom, but then Jack and Diane, which was the next record, which I vowed I'd be on the next record, which I was, which has that big drum solo, boom, blam, doosh, 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 and it was four times.
That's so iconic to hear you sing that. That's fucking the shit. All right, so
I'm playing, or maybe this is what happened before Jack and Diane. I remember I had a 12-inch rack tom, a 16-inch floor tom, and an 18-inch didn't even have hardware on the bottom. I just didn't even have a deal yet.
Right.
Didn't even have hardware. And I had the Evans hydraulic heads. You remember those fat, thick heads?
That had the oil in the middle of them? Yeah.
Yeah. And it just was like, and so the engineer comes up to me, and we're playing, we're opening up.
So your 18's like a concert tom? Like there's not, no bottom head?
No bottom head.
Yeah, okay.
And like that Phil big, Collins. It was just thuddy. We're opening up for the Kinks. So we're playing in big venues, and the engineer comes up to me and goes, Kenny, your toms, I can't get enough definition out of those drums. Do you got a smaller tom? And I went, well, I do, but John doesn't want it. And this is when I had the rack tom on a snare stand.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't mount it. I didn't want – it was old school. So I said, well, I got a smaller tom, but John's not going to like it. And then I went, hey, tell John his vocals will sound way better if I have that 10-inch tom up there. I was just joking. And I don't know if he told him that, but the bottom line is he says, put the other tom up. So, but I didn't have a holder for it, so I had to put on a snare stand. So I've got a 24-inch kick drum, and these toms are like you could drive a freight train through
between
it.
Between them. But why wouldn't you just put the 10?
Because at this point, I realized the value and the perfection of snare 12, 16 is the sound. Like right. A jazz drummer. Right. Now you go back to, they weren't dummies. They were all into like, not what looks good, but what sounds good. Putting a 10-inch right there with a 12-inch, I wasn't going to go for it. Mm-hmm. How you go 10? I guess I could have put the hi-hat out farther and then squeezed the 10-inch even far left and leave the 12 where it is. But I decided to reverse it.
Yeah.
And then.
Probably avoided hip problems too, because then you're like just being just another 2 inches after 40 years, all of a sudden it's, fuck, I can't walk.
Yeah. So, yeah, that became my thing. And then think about it. If you put your hand out 10, then left hand 12, right hand 16, babadoom, is that. But I'm sure that some of the fills I did were so out there, some guy in Japan was trying to analyze this shit going, how do you do that?
Oh, yeah, when you write, you try to figure out the sticking.
Yeah, they're trying to
figure out. I fucking hate that. I hate when that happens. And you'll have like all that, you know, the whole the bottom, the kick right left, and they went kick left right. Everybody in England went kick left right, so it had that descending sound.
That's
so
the way I do it, like Bonham.
Yeah.
I go left hand on the rack tom when I go.
Yeah.
I go left hand, right hand
that's
foot. That's what Bonham did. And you know that fill that he does in Black Dog? He goes. He leads with his left hand, so he can go left to the rack tom, left, which is it's snare tom, snare foot, but then he can move his
snare
right
tom, hand. Snare foot.
Yeah, I think it's like pull it.
No fucking. Yeah, because I used to.
Oh, snare tom. So is it. So he does it like that because he's so talented. He just thought, well, why cross over my hands? And why? He just made his hands do what? Execute a thing to get the sound he wanted. So he would go, da da do da da do da. So he did left handed, da da do da da da. As opposed to most people go, da 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 da, because they don't want to.
Yeah.
First of all, they're leading with the right hand, they're right handed. Second of all, It's easier, so, but not Bonham. No, he says,
Did you ever see those guys live? You ever see Zeppelin?
Fuck.
It's the first time you haven't been sitting up straight.
Yeah.
You just literally saw him. You're like, I never saw him.
Dude, that guy, I mean, to me.
Do you ever, like, that Royal Albert Hall, That just the way that that concert looks, you know, yeah. that DVD that released about 15 years ago, and his drum sound. It's just, I, you know what's funny about that guy? I was talking to somebody about this. There's like this whole, like, I think it's a myth that he played like these 2B giant tree trunk stick. But you look at his thing, it's like he's playing like a 5A.
Okay, let me ask you something. Do you remember what heads he's using in that? Is that how the West was won? That thing?
That all came out back then.
Okay, do you know what drum heads he had on?
The Royal Albert Hall?
Or any of that time?
Well, he used to have the black dot, like
okay,
the Tony Williams.
Okay, that's
ones,
right. He did have that.
But Song Remains the Same, he had those.
Okay, on the How the West Was Won, Coated Ambassador. Not only did he have Coated Ambassador, he on his kick drum, too. Dude, I'd blow through that shit in like three songs. Coated Ambassador, and he had a... and the snare drum. You remember when you were a little kid, you play a snare drum, and you don't change the head because you don't play that hard. You have the snare drum, and it turns black.
Mm-hmm.
And then the inside of that black gets beat out.
Clear, and you could see through the drum.
That means that drum head's been on there for 80 years. He had a snare drum live with that look. And I started studying his muscles and the way he moved. He wasn't hitting that hard. He had an incredible foot, but he wasn't hitting that hard because you cannot play a Coated Ambassador heads and make it and have it last. In a live show like they were doing. He wasn't hitting that hard. His hair was flying around. It looked like he was just a beast. And he's big. But I was watching his muscles and his every the way he moves.
Yeah, it's all wrists and fingers.
Because I play for my belly button. I'm like a martial arts player.
Right.
Started off with mallets when I started. Remember, you had to lift with your wrist because to get the yarn off of the wooden bar. So I developed wrist technique. Timpani, I use fingers to get the stick to just bounce off the timpani. Use your fingers. And then with snare drum, you do both. Because when you do double stroke low, you go wrist down and then fingers to get the rebound. And then when I started playing rock and roll, I started to use that wrist thing. And I started to go into my forearm, then into my upper arm. And then I started going with my back. And then I started realizing, well, shit, I'm going to do the Bruce Lee thing. Start playing from my gut. And it's, you know, that's how.
I just think, what little I know, obviously, I just think he just knew, Bonham, just knew how to hit a drum. He knew how to hit it and get the fuck out of the way of it and let it.
Yep.
Because I remember my generation coming up in the 80s, all as teenagers, we would. That's always that thing when people just, you know, you'd hit the bass drum and leave the beater on it.
Me
and
too.
And you'd try to, like, just bash it. Because his sound was so big. It was also, too, I mean, there was production value to it and everything. So we were sitting there trying to.
26-inch bass drum, you know.
Yeah, we were trying to get that sound.
Yeah.
You just thought, you had to hit hard. I remember buying these big, stupid, like those marching band sticks, thinking, and it just sounded like absolute shit. Like I would just sound like I was hitting a wet piece of notebook paper when I would hit it, and it just would never work. But
that's the whole point of this thing is that look, what you hear isn't what you, it doesn't add up to what you actually do to get that sound. There's so many variables.
Let me ask you a few more before we got to wrap this up, because I could literally talk to you about who's most underrated drummer.
Oh, there's a lot of underrated drummers. Phil Rudd for AC/DC.
Unbelievable, yeah.
Unbelievable. It's more like what he doesn't do. I just did Music Cares in New York where Don was his musical director, producer, hires me to do these big, huge things where I'll play with 20 artists.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of styles, you know, Merle Haggard recently, Greg Allman, Dr. John, Fleetwood Mac. That's my whole point for Music Cares, and I watched Fleetwood Mac rehearse. We were done rehearsing. I played with 8 artists. I wanted to watch them, and damn, Mick Fleetwood's bad motherfucker.
Yeah. I saw him in like 1990. He was another guy. He switched the toms, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he'd have to have that extension on his hi-hat because he was like 9 feet, he's 9 feet tall.
Ridiculous. But the thing is that these drummers are guys, I became the drummer I used to make fun of. When I was in college, like, fuck that Nigel Olsen shit and this guy, Charlie Watts, you know, even Ringo, who I thought was my idol. He is my idol. But then I went on like, you know, I mean, Billy Cobham pretty much fucked up my career because I was trying to play like him. And you know what I'm saying?
That's a young person's thought. Like, I got to go play as many notes as I can and showing off and doing all that.
I'm not
trashing Billy Cobham.
I told Billy Cobham, I said, you almost fucked up my career. It's in my book. I said, but, you know, and we're friends. There's no way I was ever going to be like Billy Cobham. And right. I learned a lot by trying. My point is that I had to learn to appreciate how brilliant a guy like Charlie Watts or Ringo Starr is, and Phil Rudd. And there's a whole slew of them.
My favorite thing about Phil Rudd is when they're coming out of like the verse or something like that. It's just always that point you think that he's going to hit the crash and he doesn't. And
I know.
He keeps playing.
I know.
And then when he finally does, he's just built up so much tension.
Yeah.
And then the song just like, it just fucking takes off. It took me, I mean, obviously I became a comedian, so I made a lot of mistakes. Yeah.
Well, you didn't make that mistake.
No, but I didn't learn that until, I was probably a comedian for 15 years. And there's that initial thing where you play to AC/DC because you think it's easy.
Yeah, you think
And
it's
you
easy.
Think you're playing it, but you're not playing. Yeah. Physically, you're doing it. And it took the longest time until I saw guys like Steve Jordan and even Steve Gadd one time would just play the most simple beat. And I just would watch those guys.
That's an example right there.
Being like, I can physically play that, but I could never even remotely make it sound.
It all comes from your head first. You got to hear it. Somebody saw me doing, I did another Music Cares. I was honoring Dylan here in L.A. Some drummers, I decided in between the rehearsal and the filming and recording. In these shows, by the way, 16-camera shoot, they're going to record it. You can't fuck up. Yeah. And you just finished rehearsing with three artists. And now you got to, that's why I write everything out. You know, so anyway, this guy's, I talked to the engineer and said, I just feel like in this room my cymbals are bright. I'm going to put up some K cymbals. You tell me. So I'm playing the simple groove, just laying it down, doing what I do. And some drummer for this other band is looking at me, shaking his head. And he comes over, and I said, is something wrong with the cymbals? He goes, no. How the fuck do you make those drums sound like that? How do you get that sound? You're not doing anything fancy. So he was telling me what I'm in awe of other drums, And I said, you know, how do I do that? He says, because I hear something, I imagine something in my head. Maybe it's John Bonham. And I imagine something in my heart. And I'm just chasing after it. Chasing after every hit, everything. I'm always going, does that sound like I want it to sound and feel the way I want it to feel? So it doesn't matter what notes I'm playing. I'm directing myself, making adjustments with my right hand, my right foot, my left foot, everything, my posture, everything, to get that kind of sound. Am I getting that sound that I'm feeling and imagining?
Yeah, so rather than just doing
it. Just doing it, yeah.
Well, you know, it was a pet peeve of mine, it still is to this day, when you watch a music video, which you don't see a lot of them, the amount of fucking times where they never had the drummer synced in correctly. Like he's hitting the snare and he's always hitting the kick and vice versa. Yeah. It's just like, and it's just the fucking worst. Or you hear him playing the hi-hat and he's fucking crashing a cymbal. They never have any fucking respect for a drummer. And I got to tell you something, dude, the amount of respect I already had for you, and just listen to, you know, your whole background and how all the stuff you've overcome and your whole attitude towards it, that you're an inspirational guy. And you sang the Jack and Diane fill. I mean, I'm fucking completed it. This is fantastic. He's got a new book out called Sex, Drums, and Rock and Roll. Kenny Aronoff, thank you so much for coming on the podcast,
man. I should say that, you know, you were saying, speaking inspirational, I've been doing a lot of, there's an article in Forbes I sent you that I don't know if you got it. I sent an article
in
Forbes.
I never look at emails. Yeah. I'll look for it.
Not email, I text you. But my point is, I've been doing a lot of speaking. That book gave me the inspiration to go out, and I have a whole show. I'm going to do Marathon Oil in 2 days, where I have a whole hour and 15 minute show. Where
Jesus Christ, I'm going to be opening for you soon. Let me do 20 minutes. Let me do 20 minutes in front of you. I can't believe I forgot. I was joking, telling you I have the VHS copies that I bought, like, I don't know how many. I bought them in the 90s where it was like your
power workouts.
Yeah, one and two. We got to hang at some point because I never do autographs. I just wanted you to sign those fucking things. I do. Kenny Aronoff,
right.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Awesome.
All right, guys. Thank you for listening.